Okay, welcome to Dallas Sponsors Forum. Glad to see everybody out on a chilly, wet night. We're a non-for-profit organization. We've been around for about 40 years or so. And I'm Rob Olson, President of Dallas Sponsors Forum. I want to thank everybody for coming out. We meet the second and the fourth Tuesday of the month from September through May. So do we have any first-time visitors? Any first-time? Okay, so, young lady, how did you find out about us?
On meetup.com.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, and you were just interested, you were in the mood for philosophy tonight? Is that how it happened? I'm in the mood for philosophy.
Philosophical than the one I'm going to give you, but I was very interested in the topic of the evening.
Okay, yeah. So you have,
are
you like me, you have an angst about death?
Actually, I just had somebody very close to me die.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And
I'm sorry.
This is the funny part. I went to the wrong funeral.
Oh, no.
And I
couldn't
make that up.
Wow. Oh, bless your heart.
But in fairness, I didn't miss the one I was supposed to be at, so it worked out.
Okay. Well, welcome. We're glad you're here. Who else is first-time visitor? Okay, so how did you hear about us? Meetup as well, or our website?
We came with a veteran.
Oh, okay. Wonderful. Wonderful. So welcome. Anybody else? Okay. I'm Duncan. He's the husband of our speaker tonight, Dr. Catherine Davies, so we welcome you as well. We are a non-for-profit organization, and we are run by non-paid volunteers, and we are in need of a volunteer to help us with the audiovisual or help us with social media. We're a bunch of old, white, balding guys, and we don't know much about social media, so we need some help, as they say in Texas. And so if you're willing and interested, please see a board member after the meeting. Everyone that's a board member, please raise your hand. So there's several of us here. So anyway, we had a board meeting recently on Sunday, and the question came up, why study philosophy? And why, what can we do to encourage people to study philosophy and attend more of our meetings? And so here's something I read on the internet. We must remember that philosophy addresses problems and questions that arise in all areas of human endeavor and experience and in all disciplines. Recurring questions about the nature of value, the good life, right conduct, knowledge, truth, language, reality are central to the philosophical study. Philosophy also investigates the methodologies and assumptions of the major disciplines to deepen our understanding of the sciences, of mathematics, art, literature, of history, and of religion and morality. It leads us to contemplate the nature of these subjects, the methods of reasoning characteristic of them, and the contributions they make to our understanding of ourselves and our world. So please keep coming to the Dallas Philosophers Forum lectures. And it's like, what I got out of that is it's going to make us all smarter. So everyone wants to become smarter, right? So that's part of our goal. And actually, I'm going to ask Dr. Davies, put her on the spot in a minute, but ask her why study philosophy, but we'll get to that in a second. If you haven't paid already, please do so immediately after the lecture. The cost is $5, best bargain in town. David Drum, our treasurer, raise your hand. So if you came before Mr. Drum arrived, please pay the $5 afterwards, because philosophy is not free. Students with an IED can attend for $2. I also want to remind everyone to pay for your meal or drinks before you leave. Every once in a while, someone will inadvertently forget to pay for the meal, and then we'll have to pay. And we're not in a position to pay for attendees' meals. And then please be generous with your wait staff. The restaurant's kind enough to provide this room. We're grandfathered in, so they don't do this anymore, but they let us continue to stay here. We've been here, what, Ken, 9 years?
Since 2009.
We have a website. Ken is our webmaster, and a lot of the same information is there, www.philosophersforum.org, and you can sign up on our email list on our website. And then also get updates on meetings through Meetup. Our speaker tonight will spend about 45 minutes with the lecture. and then open it up to questions, short statements, and then questions. I think Dr. Davies may want something a little bit more interactive than that, so obviously we'll give her carte blanche on that. Also, please turn off your cell phones or put them on vibrate mode at this time. We're very privileged to have Dr. Catherine Davies with us tonight. She's an assistant professor of philosophy at the University of Texas at Dallas. She received her MA and PhD from Emory University with her dissertation on Heidegger's Conversations, Relationality, Language, and Ethics. And I pulled up her CV. It's extremely impressive, very, very long for such a young lady. But a lot of experience and background in Plato, Heidegger, of course, Hannah Arendt, and you've done quite a bit on Guatemala, Guatemala's first private city. But a lot of the background in Heidegger and environmental philosophy, and so we're just really, really thrilled to have her with us tonight. She's taught classes on aesthetics. She just completed a class on confronting death, a graduate class on confronting death at UT Dallas. So anyway, please join me in welcoming Dr. Catherine Davies.
Well, thank you, Rob, for that really lovely introduction. So I was thinking about your question here, and Rob just asked me this a moment ago, gave me a minute to prepare. And so my perspective, obviously, on this is coming at it as a professor. I'm in the classroom, and I'm usually talking to students, right, who are going to major in philosophy, graduate students usually are already convinced, right? But undergrads, why study philosophy? What's the point? A lot of them are just in the intro class to fulfill a requirement to get on with their degree. And what I'm hearing from them, the sort of what they're getting out of the course, at least at first, is this sense that things that they came into the class thinking they couldn't ask questions about, that were certain, that they knew, that they were sure of in some kind of way, all of a sudden got called into question, right? And that in philosophical study and philosophical inquiry, this question worthiness and this questionableness opens up, right? And this is something that educators talk about in terms of critical thinking, and there's all these ways that we try to assess this and create this for our students, opportunities for our students. But students who really say, I didn't ever think that this idea of justice could be questioned, or what is truth, or what is happiness? And what ends up happening over the course of the semester and over the course of different courses they might take is that not only do they start calling into question what society society really is saying has taught them is true their entire life, but they start seeing ambiguity, right, in additional aspects of their life, right, learning to ask questions and to see things as already ambiguous. So that's part of why I think we ought to study philosophy, because it really helps structure our perception differently. Right? If you're used to asking questions, things start to show up as, well, wait a minute, is it really how it appears? Okay. Another reason to study philosophy actually happens to intersect, I think, with the topic of my presentation. I won't call it a lecture, a presentation tonight, which is a very famous definition of philosophy from the Phaedo, Plato, a Platonic dialogue, way at the beginning of the history of philosophy, where Socrates tells all of his interlocutors who are gathered around him as he's about to die for philosophy, that philosophy is a practice of dying. That in philosophizing, and what does he mean by that? Well, it's complicated. He means by that in philosophizing, you sort of leave the world for a moment. You leave your embodied practical reality, all of your everyday kinds of concerns, and you end up somewhere else. Right? You end up somewhere else for a little while. You kind of have to come back into the world after you're done thinking and questioning. And in that way, it's a kind of death to the embodied world that he thinks philosophy sort of enables and accomplishes. Right? A lot of people don't agree with him that that's what philosophy is, but that might be another reason, right? Practicing for dying. And Socrates does say, having done this, I now, facing death imminently within the next couple of hours, I'm not afraid, because I've been practicing for this my whole life. Right? This is what my life's been about. So, okay. Maybe I'll just read the sort of abstract for my presentation. Maybe you've seen it on the website already, but I think it gives us an overview kind of what I'm going to be talking about and what I hope that we can talk all about together. Okay, what do I have here? The concept death makes the absent present. So what is not all of a sudden appears. Okay? Paradoxically inviting us to confront what is unconfrontable. So my title already is a little bit misleading, maybe. Okay. No one can die for us, for each individual. Yet we can also never survive, and thus be present for our own death. So every single person dies on their own, and yet none of us are there when we go through it, right? When our death has arrived, we have departed. So instead, perhaps, what do we confront? We confront the inevitability of our approaching death, so this futural sense of death we do confront, and grapple with the events of the deaths of those around us, right? So the deaths of others actually become perhaps more immediately accessible, even than our own death, might be a question. Public intellectual Cornel West, some of you may have heard of him, has argued that philosophy as a pursuit is only possible when our infinite desire confronts the reality of its finitude and death. He doesn't think philosophy as a phenomenon ever would have been invented, ever would have emerged, if we weren't the kind of beings who try to make meaning because our time is finite. Right? We want everything, we can't have everything, so we have to make choices, right? Based on priorities of meaning. So we will explore here a number of ways in which philosophizing has emerged from, and I take that very seriously, emerged from and responded to death. We will consider various definitions of death. There are quite a few across Mystery Philosophy. The role of fear in dying, whether or not fear is even an appropriate emotion or affective response to death, and whether death is primarily an individual or a social phenomenon. All right, so I've already sort of talked a little bit about what I think that might be. What I'm going to do today is really just run through, after sort of framing the discussion in terms of why is death so important for philosophers and for philosophy, I'm just going to be showing quite a few quotes from different texts. As Rob mentioned, I have just very recently taught a graduate course on confronting death, so I'm just sort of selecting what I think are some of the highlights of the texts that I taught there. And I taught the course as well before as an undergraduate course. So we'll be doing that and hopefully just sort of talking through what we think those quotes mean when we get to that point. So, okay. So what is a human being? This is a very big question in the history of philosophy. So here are some of the answers that different philosophers have given. So Plato, right, at the very beginning of the Western philosophical tradition, we'll say that a human being, as distinct from other kinds of beings, is a thinking being, right? The kind of being that can think. What does that mean? He says in the Theaetetus, it's a being who can have a conversation with itself, right? Or he says it's in the Theaetetus, the soundless dialogue between me and myself, right? So it happens in language, and there is this sense that we aren't necessarily self-identical as human beings, but that we're sort of divided within and against ourselves, such that we can constitute a relationship with ourselves, and that's actually what thinking is us trying to navigate and construct this self-relation. Actually, in the Phaedrus, which is another dialogue by Plato, he will sort of extend this thought by saying not only is thinking a conversation you have with yourself, but it's one where you either, he says, collect together or divide apart. That these are the only things you can do in thinking. Collect particulars together or divide them, which are both modes of of gathering, right? You're either gathering one thing altogether or separating and gathering to other things, which is very important, actually, because the word language in ancient Greek, logos, is derived from the Greek verb legein, which means just to gather. Before it meant language at all, it was just gathering together in this sort of hunter-gatherer kind of a way, right? Collecting. So, we have two other very famous definitions from Aristotle, who was Plato's student. One is the rational animal. So on logon ekon, the animal that has reason. Okay, and reason here is starting to sound like logic, right? The capacity to deduce or induce arguments from universals and particulars. We also have this definition that human being is the political animal. Okay, that one often, I think, is forgotten. The rational animal, that's a big one. A lot of philosophers pick that up. But for Aristotle, it's just as important that the human being is political. And what does he mean by that? He means that we are the kinds of beings that aren't just, we're not just social. We do like to be around each other. We can't really survive without one another. But really what he means by political is that we create the space for the exercise of virtue. Okay, and if you know anything about Aristotle's ethics, it really does come down to virtue and practicing these certain courage, right? Is a really good example of a virtue. You actually can't practice a virtue without others to sort of witness it, Aristotle thinks. And it's the political realm that's going to give you those witnesses. Okay. Hegel, jumping way ahead into German idealism, right? Hegel will say, what is a human being? It's a being, a natural being. We are created by nature. We exist in nature. But nevertheless, we're a natural being that can act against nature. We can turn against it somehow, right? It's very violent, kind of an understanding. Nietzsche also, he has many ways of thinking about what a human being is, but my favorite is the interesting animal, right? He's definitely thinking about Aristotle here. But what does he mean by interesting? Well, in this particular case, I took this from the genealogy of morals. It has to do with the capacity we have to reverse values, right? So you can say, oh, this person has told me this is what is good. I'm going to actually now call that bad or evil. Right, and assign good to this others, assign this value to something else. So that's Nietzsche. Judith Butler, also, she's a philosopher who's still alive and working and writing today. She would say that a human being is a being who lives two lives, not just one, but two. One would be biological, physiological, the sense of life that we may share with, we do share with animals, plants, these sorts of things. And another, we also lead another life that's defined by our relations to others. Okay, so not quite political for her, but social might be a good way to think about it. Okay, so here's a few examples. So my question here, but what about death? Isn't death a good way to think about what is the human being? Of course, we share. The fact of death, that we die, with many other beings, animals, and plants, vegetative life as well. But isn't there something specific about the way that we relate to death that might differentiate us, if we even want to differentiate ourselves, right, as human beings from other kinds of beings? There's certain philosophers who say, no, we shouldn't do that. That's actually a bad project. Okay. But what about death? So several pre-Socratic thinkers, this is now historically before Plato, before any of the quotes that I just mentioned, the epic poet Homer wrote the Iliad and the Odyssey, right? And the tragedian Sophocles, who very famously wrote Antigone, for instance, right? Defined human beings not in reference to our capacity for reason, to reason logically, or our relatedness to others, whether that's a social or a political relation, but rather in reference to our relation to death. Okay? For both of these thinkers, Homer and Sophocles, human beings are the kind of being that are stranded. They do put it in this sort of dire kind of way. Stranded between animals who are going to die but don't know it, okay, and the gods, in this case the Greek gods, right, who aren't going to die and know that, and they derive some security from this, right? So human beings are the kind of being who are going to die and know it, right? And that knowledge becomes a source of affliction, struggle. For someone like Achilles, a very important choice has to get made because of this fact, right? So human beings are thus first and foremost mortals. So this slide, this is a quote I'll talk through here in just a minute that I actually pulled from, that I'm working on in the third chapter of my book manuscript right now that Rob mentioned. I'm working on a book on Heidegger's dialogues, right? He wrote some dialogues I've been thinking about for a while. So he here talks about different ways to determine what or who the human being is that in fact intersect with what I was just talking about. So here, this older man is speaking to his interlocutor, and I'll read this really quickly for us. He says, whenever we previously spoke about the essence of the human, so the definition of the human, what is it? Okay? And this means about the occidental determination of the essence of the human. By occidental there, he means the Western tradition. Right, their definition. So he's thinking the one that starts with Plato and Aristotle. Okay, this Western determination, philosophical determination. Each time you focused only on the characterization of the human as the living being that thinks. So back to Plato, right? The thinking being, or the being with reason, is what it becomes for Aristotle. To be sure, this definition was already common in the ancient Greek world. But in the most ancient Greek world, even before Plato and Aristotle, the human was thought otherwise, namely as ho phaetos, as the mortal in distinction to the immortals, the gods. This characterization of the human seems to me to be incomparably deeper than the first one mentioned, which is gained by means of holding in view the human by himself, isolated and detached from the great relationships in which he properly stands. So there are two definitions that he's working with here, right? The first, which is the sort of younger definition, the human being as the being that thinks. Then this older definition is the human being as the mortal. And the reason Heidegger thinks this definition is better, philosophically better or deeper, at the very least, is because death somehow allows to emerge the importance of relations or relationships that we have. Perhaps it's with other people, perhaps it's just with the earth or nature, the fact that we are natural beings that demise just like other organisms. Right? So, here's Robert Pilkerison. This is a book I really enjoy and would highly recommend if any of you are interested in reading more about death, and especially continental philosophy on death. It's this book called The Dominion of the Dead, which is where I brought this quote from. So I'll read this one, and then instead of me talking us through it, I would like to ask you all if you have any thoughts about how we might want to interpret or understand this passage. So I'll read it first. Humans vary not simply to achieve closure and effect a separation from the dead, but also, and above all, to humanize the ground on which they build their worlds and found their histories. And since I will be referring to the human rather often in these pages, let me put forward a premise here to the effect that humanity is not a species. Homo sapiens is a species. It is a way of being mortal and relating to the dead. To be human means, above all, to bury. Anybody like to jump in, say what they think is going on in this passage? What you understand by it?
I think we're a shy group. So.
Not that I have anything important to say, but I figure I might as well get things started.
Yeah, thank you.
Everybody's time.
Great.
So, burying the dead is something unique to humans. We don't see other critters doing that very often.
Yeah.
And for me, burial is really important for the closure
mm-hmm.
and for the connection to other humans that are left alive.
Right.
So I'd like to hear your opinion about that.
Right. It is a very much a social kind of a phenomenon, right? And he does mention this here, that there's a achieving of closure that happens when we bury our dead. And although it's not as clear here, he does go on to talk about how that's a very much a socially derived sense of closure, that we need others to share in our grief, right? To help us give voice to our feeling and to bring us back into that social world, because he worries that grief is something that's very isolating. When you're going through, you feel like you can't connect, and so this closure allows us to connect to others, as a matter of fact. Yeah.
What about the cultures that cremate their dead?
Right, that's a good question, and that gets at what he means by burial. Right, so, I would like to come back to that.
Actually, I can speak on that as well. About 8 years ago, half my family perished in mm-hmm. a separate incident, and there was, four bodies in a mortuary, which is expensive, right? So we cremated everybody. We didn't have much of any kind of service because it was out of state, so there was not a lot of closure in the physical realm of things, right? It was mm-hmm. just there, one day or gone, right? Whereas last week, as I shared with everybody, I had somebody else very close with me pass away. And in fact, the first thing I thought to myself when I stepped out of the vehicle to go to this funeral was and pardon my language, I was like, shit just got real. Mm-hmm. I was just like, whoa, this just became very real. Like, this person died and I cannot ignore it. Mm-hmm. And so that was something that I didn't experience this 8 years ago. And I had not had anybody that close die in just about those 8 years. But when it was somebody like that and I showed up to this funeral, it just was very in your face. There's no cognitive dissonance. The spit's in the glass. This person died. And so that was, it's very interesting that you guys are talking about, burying people, but also the cremation, the crematory part of this, right? That times are changing. As we understand global warming more, we may burn the bodies versus bury bodies, for different reasons, cultural reasons, right? So it's just really interesting.
Yeah. Well, first, I'm sorry for your losses.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, but I think that's right. There is something about the reality of burial, right? Especially when you see a corpse, right? It's there, it's undeniable in some way, right? And it gives you a task. You must do something now with it, right? Cremation, maybe, it's a different process. There still is something material. There still is something to sort of do, right? But what's interesting to me about this quote is that burial, he sort of gives us sort of two, I think, meanings to that term in this quote. One is very much what does it mean, putting a body in the ground, of course, right? But we also have this idea here of humanizing the ground on which we build our world and found our histories, okay? And this meaning of burial I take to be a more philosophical kind of a claim, a more, if you would want to think of it this way, a metaphorical kind of a claim, right? That there's something about those who have come before us, right, who make possible the world in which we live, right? So I'll ask my students when I teach this, how many words did you use today that you invented, that you came up with? I mean, maybe you did. It's possible. Some people say, oh, yeah, I came up with this, new phrase today. Okay, cool, right? Most likely you used thousands of words that were all invented by someone who is now dead, right? That there's something about that those dead people that have humanized our world, made it possible for us to now be humans in relation to one another, to have conversations.
See, a lot of the sadness from death is it's the end.
like an end to your relationship, an end to those joys. But somewhat, I've experienced that, like when you graduate from high school, mm-hmm. and they say, this is the last time this entire group will be together. And you think back, and it's kind of sad because all these people you'll never see again. Mm-hmm. I've encountered a 50th high school reunion, and only about, you know, a quarter of us mm-hmm. came back. The other is, if you've had a, I don't know if you ever had a boyfriend that got married when they're a little twang of, well, that's the end, even if you're the one that dumped him. You know, it's like that's the end of that.
Right.
So it's the end. I think that's the ending of something refreshes your recollection of all these experiences, joyful experiences you have.
Right, absolutely. And there is a historicality, right? That now you realize I am a kind of being that has a past that's not just past, but is meaningful to me, right?
You know, from what you just said, right, is the death of different things. You talked about Plato in the beginning, about his philosophy was that we have, like, death is, you know, over and over, right? And you said the philosophy is born in death. And I really think that, you know, what you said may stand, but I thought that an even broader idea was that lots of things die all the time, over and over, whether it's, and a lot of it really, well, I would say the ones that we suffer, the death that we suffer from the most are the ones that involve people, and that could be relationships, friendships, it could be anything, right, or something that we're really close with, but when maybe an idea dies, maybe you had a really great idea, you talk to people, and that's dead, because they're like, oh, it wasn't that good, right, mm-hmm. that's a death, and that can even be a death that affects you a lot, because you were very married to this idea. And so I think if you think of death as something that happens all the time around us and not in necessarily the physical realm,
right.
that it, I think it speaks a lot to what Plato was trying to say.
Absolutely. No, I think that's right. And just thinking about death in this one narrow way of, oh, I'm going to die someday, that's an important way to think about it. That's not the only way to think about it. And so when you're saying ideas can die, I do think Poe-Harrison is saying bury those. Right, there's something about burying them that then end up humanizing our ground, whatever it is that we are going forward into. We carry those memories and those losses with us. That's what it means to be mortal. Right? Who's next?
Oh, Jack was next.
Okay.
So I'm going to go out a little bit on a limb here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to kind of go down the path of the fear and trembling and angst of death, and one way to maybe enhance our mortality or maybe achieve at least temporarily immortality is to bury other people, is
mm-hmm.
to kill other people,
yeah.
is to have power over other people by fighting a battle or putting them out of business, or defeating them in business, but the idea of making the other person die
mm-hmm.
makes us more powerful, or it extends our mortality, it makes us feel alive.
Feel less mortal, maybe, right? Less vulnerable because we have this power. Yeah, there's a lot of other ways that killing others, or at least assigning death to be a phenomenon that happens to other people, right, not me, does end up insulating you and serves as a sort of psychical protection against you know, the fact that death actually is a very real phenomenon that could happen to anyone at any time, right? It's not some distant futural possibility. It's an ever-present, imminent imminence. That's what Heidegger is going to say when I get to that quote, right?
It's a formal presentation.
I think now we don't deal with death. I mean, in the 19th century, a lot of women died in childbirth. There were wars, epidemics. You never knew when it was going to be the end. But now we live most of our lives, I think, in denial, saying, "Oh, I'm young. I'll live to 80 or 90."
Right.
And I don't think we have as much appreciation for our connection with our ancestors. I mean,
right.
In Chinese culture and other cultures, people more or less worship their ancestors and appreciate that they're a derivative of their ancestors.
Right.
Now we're, new technology was invented, nothing new was invented until I was born, so, I mean, there are a lot of people with that attitude,
right.
young people, I mean.
Right, absolutely. I mean, it's important to note that, you know, when the pre-Socratics were talking about how human beings are mortal. This is what we are over and above anything else. They were dealing with, you know, a time period where the average life expectancy was lower than 30, right? 28, 29. People were dying all the time.
Catherine, just let us know when you want to move to the next slide.
Okay. Maybe I'll move us to the next and we'll continue.
We had one other comment first.
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
Have you looked at near-death experiences?
Have I looked at them?
Mm-hmm.
Studied.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say I've studied them from a philosophical viewpoint, no. I would be curious to talk about them, but yeah. Okay. So I learned when I got here that in fact there is no internet, so I'm not going to be able to show this YouTube video about Cornel West, but I can just summarize really quickly. It's what I already mentioned. Ellie talks about a lot in this clip, but one of them is the fact that he does not think that philosophy or philosophizing as the sort of, you know, seeking out answers to these big, you know, arguably unanswerable questions would have arisen at all if we weren't in beings that have infinite desire and finite time, that we're going to die, right? I'll skip over that. Now I'm going to turn to the first line of Albert Camus' The Myth of Sisyphus, which is a very important line, I think, in the history of philosophy, where he says, there is but one truly serious philosophical problem, and that is suicide. It's the only one. Okay? Judging whether life is or is not worth living amounts to answering the fundamental question of philosophy. So this is a big, big claim. anybody have any thoughts about this quote? Oh, quite a few.
Well, it's something.
Hold on, we have to take turns here.
Okay, sir.
Yeah, I had a thought. I recently read Dostoevsky's The Zest with Karamazov, who Camus had a lot to say about that, but it was basically the logical suicide. I think that's basically what he was talking about. I wondered what you had to say about that character. I'm guessing you're probably familiar with it.
I know of it, but I haven't read it, so I can't comment right now.
Okay. Yeah, that was the fictional equivalent to what Camus was talking about, because he didn't have
Right. I mean, and Camus, this is the only, you know, strictly philosophical essay that he wrote, and in it he talks a lot about Heidegger and Kierkegaard and some other philosophers. Most of his work is literature. It's literary or it's plays or this sort of thing. So.
Question here.
It's not a comment, it's a question. Speaking of Heidegger, can you tell me how this ties in with Heidegger's concept of proneness? I think proneness is how it was translated when
yeah.
I read it.
Yeah, Geborgenheit. Proneness. Well, for him, what proneness is about is the fact that we just find ourselves thrown into the world, right? We didn't really choose our situation. We're just here all of a sudden. How do you see it being relevant to this quote?
It seems relevant to me to this quote because it is stating that assuming we have a choice about whether or not to live, which I guess we do because we can commit suicide, but the idea of proneness is we kind of don't get a choice about whether or not to live. We're here.
Right. So the choice is deferred already, right? Yeah. We're already here. We didn't get a choice about that. Whatever choice we make is going to be secondary, right? But we have to make a choice. Right, this is his existentialism in some ways coming up. We have to judge whether or not life is worth living, right? We actually can't get outside. We can't get around the fact that we have to philosophize at some point about this question.
So the question here is, why isn't that a choice that we have without judgment? Right, why is life worth living or not worth living without judgment, right? The question is to say that, or maybe, I want to say this other question. So maybe it's just to say that suicide, right? People are saying, okay, it's immoral, don't do it, all these things. Mm-hmm. But why can't we have that choice without feeling like that? Like when you look at doctor-assisted suicide, right? Like you think of things like that.
when you determine that you're suffering so much that it's up to you to make that decision. So the question is, when did that become a question of morality?
Whether or not we choose to die or not.
Right.
Yeah, I would say that it would have to do probably to do with religion,
right.
where it originated. And it's not the case, you know, the physician-assisted suicide, for instance, right, in my medical ethics class, I teach about this. This is something that's a very live debate in this country, at least today, and there are states where it is very much legal, and the thought is it is your decision, right? In that case, the question of suffering actually becomes the important criteria, not necessarily judging, you know, in a philosophical sense, is life worth living? Is my life worth living? You might say, is my life with this suffering worth living? You know, would sort of shift the question philosophically for me a bit, but I do see that relation.
So I find this quite interesting because it implies that there is only one question and only one answer. And for me, I think each of us have this question to ask ourselves, and each of us have an answer.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Camus, as you mentioned, was a writer, mm-hmm. and he wasn't known necessarily as a philosopher, even though his works generate a lot of conversation. I think we're judging him in this quote a little bit too harshly by making it about one thing. I think really what this says is the truly serious philosophical problem for each of us is suicide.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do we live or do we die?
Right.
How do we choose that?
And why, exactly. What are the criteria, right? That's what judgment, philosophically speaking, is, right? You have a lot of particulars and then you make a call, right?
It's not just medical assistance suicide, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I would think the question of suicide might not be just whether life is worth living abstractly, but what duties we have to other people
mm-hmm.
that might be impacted by
right.
the decision.
The
suicides I've been closest to have inflicted serious suffering on other people.
Others.
Beyond the ones taking their own lives.
Right.
It's not so much duties, I think. I don't think it's so much duties as our perception of our impact on other people. Do we perceive we have an impact on other people or not?
Right. And it does get at this question I tried to frame my talk with at the beginning was whether or not we want to think about death as strictly an individual phenomenon or we want to think about it as a social phenomenon, right? Especially given the fact that once we're dead, we're not here. We're gone. It's other people around us who literally have to pick up the pieces, right? There's something material we leave behind that has to be dealt with in some way, right? Okay, go. Next. Okay, this question, philosophical question, what is death? Okay, I'm going to look at some of the answers that have been provided across the history of philosophy for us to think about. And these two questions that perhaps go along with this larger philosophical question, when does death happen? When do we think it can happen? When can it not happen? And to whom does death happen? So this gets a little bit at what we were just discussing, right? Does my death happen to me primarily, or does it happen to other people? Right? Okay, what do I have for this? Oh, starting with Plato. So two quotes from the Phaedo, which is the dialogue by Plato that is the sort of day, the day or it's the full day leading up to his death after he has been sentenced to death for practicing philosophy and ostensibly corrupting the youth of Athens and blaspheming against the gods of the city, right? Okay, so let's look at these definitions he gives us. The first, and is this what it means to have died? For the body to have become separate once it's freed from the soul and is itself all by itself, and for the soul to be separate once she's freed from the body and is herself all by herself. Death couldn't be anything other than this, could it? This is in the context of a dialogue, so he's talking to someone, right? So what do we think about this definition? What is death? Well, it's merely the separation from the soul and the body. They're just apart now. Whereas life is when they are together in some way.
Certainly Western philosophy.
certainly Western philosophy, right? That the soul and body are different, right? That's a big assumption in most of the Western philosophical tradition.
Well, is there a soul?
Is there a soul, right? You have to buy a lot, right? To buy this definition of death, that in fact we have souls.
Is it possible that part of the origination of religion itself is this fear of death, this understanding that we have finite time, so we want some type of explanation that's beyond ourselves that could overcome this sense of mortality that we have?
Right. I mean, potentially that could be one way to think about it. We're actually going to look at a quote here in a few minutes from Augustine's Confessions, where he's speaking specifically about the death of his mother, Monica, and what her death means in the context of religion and how it might be different than what someone like Plato would think of it as. Although Plato, you know, has a theory of reincarnation, it's a little different than maybe the religious sort of explanations of the afterlife that we are more familiar with maybe today in this country.
Yeah, well, this is obviously that Plato was a dualist.
Yes, obviously.
Spirit and matter. Mm-hmm. And that and the early Christians really bought this. Neoplatonism, you know, that, I mean, this played right into the,
yes,
the concept of the soul, etc. So.
No, absolutely. I mean, arguably, Thomas Aquinas really pulled from Aristotle in most ways, right? And Aristotle got so much from Plato. Yeah.
How do you relate this to rebirth? You know, in Buddhist religion or whatever you call it, mm-hmm. there is no death. In the sense, you are born again.
Right.
So there's no soul, that's what I'm trying to say. So when there's no soul, how do you interpret this clause?
When there's no soul? How would you understand this? Well, he thinks there is
a soul.
Right.
Hindu and Buddhist, yeah.
Right. Well, Plato does believe in the soul, and he has a theory of reincarnation that he proves in some really interesting ways. He actually doesn't think learning is possible, right? So this is from the Meno. He says, or he gives you this question to his interlocutors. If you really, truly don't know the answer to a question, and in this case he's talking about geometry, but it could be anything. If you really, truly do not know the answer to a question, how would you ever know when the right answer appears? How would you ever recognize it as the right answer? Right? If you really don't know, if you're really asking the question, how would you know? Okay? And his theory is, well, it's recollection. You're remembering something that you knew when you were not yet born, right? Before you were born, reborn, right? Reincarnated, drink from the river Lethe and forget everything.
Plato.
Yeah, reincarnation, yeah. So he has that. He doesn't have that particular problem, but other philosophers definitely do, right? Anything else on this? I mean, the second quote, actually, I already mentioned, at the beginning, where he says those who practice philosophy in the right way are in training for dying, and they fear death least of all men, right? Which one of the things that's really remarkable about the Phaedo and his interlocutors keep remarking upon is that he is his usual self. Even though he knows he's going to drink the hemlock, he knows he's going to die that day, right? He's not afraid. And he says, well, this is what I've been practicing for my whole life. I've been trying to separate my soul out of my body because I know that the knowledge I get from my body is kind of confused and perception isn't very clear and doesn't get me to truth. So I try to not engage my body as much as I can, right? And just think, right? In a separate kind of way. Okay. So here we have a few quotes from Montaigne's essay to philosophize is to learn how to die. He takes this quote from Plato, from the Phaedo, and then wrote an essay. He's arguably the first essayist. He invented the genre, Michel de Montaigne. So the first quote here is actually him kind of rehearsing this Epicurean position. He says, death does not concern you, dead or alive. alive because you are, dead because you are no more. Okay, so here's an argument that, you know, don't worry about it. Don't even, you, if there's no point in thinking about it, it literally does not concern you. You are not the kind of being for whom death is a concern. What do we think about this?
It's clearly wrong.
It's clearly wrong. Okay.
Well,
wow.
I think
that
the
way
to something you said earlier, in fact, I wrote it down, I'll go back over it. You mentioned that there's these, that we are basically between heaven and
that's the pre-Socratic.
Animals, right,
yes.
Animals that don't know they're dying, mm-hmm. and gods that know, but they're like never going to die, and they know it. Mm-hmm. So, I think that's interesting that, you know, this focus, basically what you're saying is the focus of all life is death, because that's where we're headed and we know it. And so, I disagree that animals don't know they're going to die, and the reason is this, mm-hmm. is because if you lived a life where you knew, you didn't know you were going to die, or it just wasn't conceptualized that that could happen. Like, I wrote this, and it says, what would you be afraid of if you couldn't die? Why would you be afraid of anything ever? If even if you had pain, you'd say, I'm going to get over the pain, I'm still going to be alive, right? What would you, you wouldn't have fear for anything ever at all, right? You wouldn't be afraid of a roller coaster. You wouldn't have anxiety about flying. You would look both ways for you, cross the street. There's a lot of things that fear of death, I think, keeps us alive.
Mm-hmm.
And so I definitely disagree that animals don't fear death,
okay.
because they absolutely are running, you know.
Okay, sure, sure, sure. Yeah, I guess the question there would be, is it their fear derived from knowledge, what philosophers would call knowledge, or is it instinct, right? And is instinct something that's different than knowledge?
So an instinct saying that we instinctually
try to stay
alive. Have a concept that there is something bad, like, i.e. death, going to happen.
Maybe not that far, but there is an instinct to try to stay alive, to just for survival. Whether or not there's a question of what...
Let's focus on people with the microphone, please.
Yeah, I would disagree. I agree that animals don't think about death. They don't get anxious about it. You may see a little squirrel in the yard, and he's always looking around, always popping up.
Mm-hmm.
But that's instinctual, and he doesn't have anxiety about it. He just does what he knows is, you know, what's instinctual about staying alive. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't go back up into his little nest and say, oh, my God. My life, I'm already worried about some animal swooping down and getting me. It doesn't, they don't have that anxiety.
You know?
And I think we should live in the moment like animals and little children. And maybe that's what Montagna is saying.
Mm-hmm.
Just live in the moment, you know. It's, I mean, you gotta, you know, put oil in your car and buy life insurance.
Mm-hmm.
But you should live in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Cheers for that.
This gentleman over here, a comment, a question.
No, I already heard it.
Okay. Did you have a comment?
Oh,
yeah. Many people fear death.
Yes.
And I believe it was Seneca, the Roman Stoic,
mm-hmm.
If I'm not mistaken,
mm-hmm.
that said, either death is, either there is life after death or something that follows death,
mm-hmm.
in which case death is merely a portal
to transition.
Another life,
mm-hmm.
so not to be feared.
Yep.
Or there isn't anything after death, and death is just sort of like sleeping in a dreamless state. So that shouldn't be feared either.
Right.
So and of course he was condemned to death by Nero,
right.
and so he took his own life. By suicide. So what do you think about his concept?
Oh, yeah, no, he's very much influenced by Epicurus and the Stoics, yeah, very much about self-control and moderation, and although pleasure is important to them too, surprisingly.
But
fear, right, so fear is what's added, right, from this picture. Montaigne here and Epicurus is just going to say it's about concern. It isn't about you, right? But now we have this added layer of fear, okay, and this emotional response. And fear is a very particular kind of phenomenon, right? Oftentimes there's a distinction drawn between anxiety and fear, where anxiety doesn't have an object, it's an objectless kind of a state, right? You're just always anxious, what of, well, I don't know what, right? But fear, there's a definite object, right? I'm afraid of that bear over there coming and hurting me, right? And so the objection there is that fear of death doesn't make sense, right? Because death is not an object, like you just said. Either it's nothing, or it's just a transition, right? It's more of the same, in fact. Okay, so in that case, it also isn't an object. So fear is inappropriate. Mm-hmm.
Sure. So I want to bounce a little bit off of Kristen said, which is, so we started out with this idea in the pre-Socratic philosophers that the thing that makes you human, and it's a common thread running through a lot of this, is the contemplation of death, coming to die. Mm-hmm. And then this very first quote is, death doesn't concern you, dead or alive. Alive because you are, and dead because you are no more. Okay. We have earlier philosophers, earlier in these slides, defining being a human being as being aware of your death. This quote is saying, oh, don't worry about it, don't think about it. So this quote is saying, from the context of these earlier philosophers, be an animal.
In a way, yeah, he is arguing against them, but he's also saying implicit in this quote is you have to make the choice for it not to concern you, to disengage, right? And animals, you know, perhaps don't have that choice, but no, I like that. That's a nice insight.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I guess we all have different experiences, but my colleague here on my right said about living the moment and all that. Actually, I get more pleasure, and many people do, by planning for a vacation. You have as much fun as actually getting there. And the experience of thinking ahead and planning and when it's over. So I don't, it seems to be very empty just to live in the moment. But that is a philosophical question. And maybe he may want to respond.
Well, yeah, I mean, a lot of people get a lot of joy out of thinking about going to heaven, and that's planning for the future for sure. But that gives me a little anxiety as well. I mean, what is there going to be for me to do up there? Play on my little harp and forever, never, never, you know.
Sure.
So that's
a much larger philosophical question. What's more interesting?
Mark Twain said, heaven for climate and hell for company. This gentleman over here.
I like Kierkegaard's definition of anxiety, desiring that which one dreads. I don't want to go all Freudian on everybody here, but Freud did talk a lot about our unconscious desires, and the whole idea of Eros and Thanatos, where
in the death drive.
There is a kind of death instinct or death drive in us.
Yeah.
And he certainly pointed to how we politically, as well as relationally and in the other kind of way, organize ourselves to, in fact, die. Mm-hmm. But there's a kind of unconscious rage about life, that we're offended by it, that somehow we feel thrown from whence we don't know, but we're angry about it. We feel alienated about it. His whole sense of that is. So he constructs this whole idea of how we desire it, and yet we fight against it,
right,
in a way. And so when we're afraid of death, we're kind of afraid of our own inner conflict with it. Because, you know, Aunt Sadie dies, and we're glad she's dead, but we aren't. And so we have all of this inner conflict that creates this desiring that which we dread, and all of this sort of stuff.
That's right. Yeah, Beyond the Pleasure Principle is a blindingly difficult essay. And for Freud, it really does come down to this conflict between the two drives, right, that he develops there. The death drive is certainly one, and it is this conservative instinct to sort of, he says, return to a prior state. And in that way, I think he's reading Plato, right, this return to what we were before we were born. Right, which ultimately is dead or is not non-life, right? But there's always this fight with what he calls Eros. That's the competing instinct, right? And that's the instinct towards the future, towards combination with others, towards creation, right? And so again, you have kind of the same thought that Cornel West was tracking, the what are we? We're the kinds of beings who have infinite desire and also finite time, right? It's death and eros in some ways that are
fighting. We have about 10 more minutes. If you have more slides.
Go through. Yes, a few more.
10 or 15 minutes.
There's a few good ones here, but I'm going to have to skip over. Well, this is the quote from Augustine's Confessions. Maybe I'll talk through this just really quickly. But here Augustine is describing the funeral of his mother. She has just died. Okay, and he says of her, right, "We did not think it right that a funeral such as hers should be celebrated with tears and groans and lamentations. These are ways in which people grieve for an utter wretchedness in death, or as a kind of total extinction. She did not die in misery, nor was she altogether dead." Okay? What's changed here is that Augustine is coming from a very explicit religious Christian context, right? And he tells us very explicitly here, she isn't actually dead. She didn't really all the way die, right? There's a sense in which she did, but there's another sense in which she didn't. This phenomenon just means something else to us now, right? What else do we have? Oh, some Heidegger. So these are a few quotes, two quotes here from Heidegger's Being and Time. Very difficult. And then another one from the evening conversation I quoted earlier. I'll talk us through this one, I suppose, at least. So Heidegger says here, death is the possibility of the impossibility of existence in general. The possibility of the impossibility of existence in general. Okay? The question that I think is raised that it's most interesting in this, and there's quite a lot going on, that this word possibility is what first drew my attention and my curiosity here. For Heidegger, death is only ever a possibility, which is kind of a strange thought, because the one thing you know for sure, at least at this point in human history, about every single person that you meet, is that they will die. Right? Death is a very actual reality, futural reality. And so for Heidegger to say it's a possibility, and it's only ever a possibility, is very provocative philosophically. The reason that it's only ever a possibility is because for Heidegger, when your death has arrived, you have departed. Right? You're not actually ever there. Death as an individual phenomenon, your death, will never happen to you. So, phew, no big deal, right? That's one way to think about it. Another quote here that's also very difficult, he defines death here as one's almost because it's the experience or the phenomenon that you are being towards, as a matter of fact, because you don't ever experience it. You're being towards that is the thing that is most your own. Of anything that you have, your futural death belongs the most to you. There are many other things that might happen to you that you can share with others to some varying degree, but death is something that people can't go through with you, right? He thinks you're isolated and alone. And in that way, right? Non-relational, also, you can't relate to others while you're going through it, or to other people as they're going through it. And insuperable, you can't get around it, right? There's no way around it, he thinks. Possibility as such is an imminent imminence, right? This is in 26 that he wrote this, 1926. Now in 1947, he changes a bit his tone and the way that he writes. I, in fact, think the later Heidegger is clearer, quite a bit clearer. He says here, death itself is something that waits in us, something that we carry around with us always. This is a quote from Leo Tolstoy's novella, The Death of Ivan Ilyich. Perhaps you've read it or heard of it. This, in fact, is the only piece of literature that Heidegger in Being and Time footnotes. Okay? And it's this book, and it's about this phenomenon, that at the very beginning, the first chapter, a lot of his friends and colleagues discover through the newspaper, in fact, that their friend has, or colleague has died, right? And each of them thought or felt, right, you see, he's dead and I'm not, right? There's something about the fact that one dies. That's what Heidegger calls the one dies analysis. Someone else dies. And what does that help you feel? Oh, well, it wasn't me, right? I'm not the kind of being that dies. Other people die. And there's something deeply comforting in that experience, right? Schadenfreude there as well. I'm going to skip over the Nagel. And this one, maybe I'll start on this one, this quote, which is gets at that question I had about when do we die, right? So we have this quote from this Auschwitz survivor, where she says, "I died in Auschwitz, but no one knows it." Okay, she's clearly alive, right, and writing in this organic, corporeal kind of way. But nevertheless, she's trying to articulate an experience that she's had, right? That she did die, right? What is the word death? What is the experience death there mean for her? Okay. This is actually quoted in an article by Susan Bryson. She's a feminist philosopher who's working today in this article on Living Oneself, where she says the study of trauma also replaces the traditional philosophical puzzle about whether the soul can survive the death of the body, right? Whether, in fact, death is the separation of soul and body, that the soul survives, right? That's another assumption that Plato has, for sure. Okay, it replaces that puzzle with the question of whether the self can reconstitute itself after obliteration at the hands of another, all right? This gets at the idea of what she and others, including Orlando Patterson, will call social death, right? The fact that the context of our lives and the meaning that we rely on others to generate for and with us, that being withheld or revoked, in fact, is a kind of death within life. So I had other slides, but we're about out of time.
A few more minutes.
A few more minutes. Okay, but there's one question.
Are we able to still kind of
sure.
Comment? Is that
sure.
Okay?
Yeah, yeah.
So if will you go back to the other slide, the one with the comment from, yes. So it's so interesting that she says, "I died in Auschwitz, but no one knows it."
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we all have to suffer in life. Right? Mm-hmm. The whole goal, I think, is to reduce the amount of suffering that we have to do. And, and I'm sure each person in this room could probably say that they've experienced times where, especially when somebody close to you dies, like if you have a spouse die or a parent, it's like you were a person with them in your life, and then they died, and then you were another person.
Right?
And I think that happens to us more often than we realize. And it's not to say that, and this goes into this reincarnation, idea of reincarnation for Plato, mm-hmm. It's that we can be reincarnated within this life many different times, but it takes rebuilding, right? So when she walked out of Auschwitz, she was dead inside, that's what she was saying. And so, you know, if she's still alive today, maybe you'll talk to her and she said, you know what, I rebuilt when I died. I rebuilt, like a phoenix, right? The idea of a phoenix.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's just so interesting that she was able to materialize that into words and be like, this is what happened, I actually died.
Right.
You know, I think that's so powerful.
It is very powerful. There's actually a commentator this makes me think of on Heidegger, actually, who argues that the word death or dying in Heidegger actually doesn't mean what we think of when we think of dying, which is like a life ending in some way. He thinks that Heidegger has other words for that, perishing, demise, it's all very technical and complicated, right? But that dying is actually a phenomenon that you survive for Heidegger. It's something that you are being towards death, that that's what authentic dying actually is knowing you're going to die, and freely, and he says anxiously, actually he thinks anxiety is good in this case, that you have anxiety towards your death that opens up a kind of freedom for it. Right, and to it and towards it, where death ends up being possibility as such, right, that you walk out of some experience where all of the reference, all of the meaning that you have based your life on, you've oriented your life through and around, sort of collapse, right, it talks about global collapse of meaning, right, and that dying or being towards your death is the capacity to freely say, yes, and now I'm going to do it again.
Right,
that you have another life in some kind of way. And I think that this idea of dying in an experience gets at that. Yeah.
The last word. The question about when a person dies has become a medical question now. You know, when a person is in a vegetative state, when they don't have a mind anymore, they just have a heart beating, are they alive? A rabbi once said, they're not really, they're already dead, they're just waiting to be buried.
Mm-hmm.
And even if we say, well, the heart's still beating, you know, what if there's an artificial pacemaker, you know, keeping the heart beating? So the definition of when a person is dead is really coming up, you know, legally.
Absolutely, absolutely. I know there are several cases, even in Texas recently, where this has come up. And I do think, right, this is more in my medical ethics class, I'll talk about this, but the introduction of technology and so much technology into medical treatment, right, and really in the last 30 or 40 years, right, has made it such that many people who end up at some point on life support or in the intensive care unit, death, natural death, the idea of natural death is no longer available, right, as a phenomenon or a process, right? Once you're hooked up to certain machines, right, you must be unhooked from them, and someone has to make that choice, and it's probably not going to be you, right? So that becomes a whole nother level of death is an artificial phenomenon now, and how do we cope with that?
Give a round of applause.